This Week in Retronauts, take it from me, gamers just don't understand. Hi everyone, it's Retronauts, and I am the Fresh Prince of video games? I don't know. Anyway, I'm Jeremy Parrish, and I'm here not to rap at you, just to talk. We're going to be talking about misunderstood games. And here with me in this hotel room in New York, it's not as weird as it sounds, I promise, we have luminaries. It's a star-studded event. And there are people here to talk about things that they don't understand and feel that others don't understand. So before we begin, let's do the round robin of introductions clockwise from me. Not that anyone listening to this knows what that means.
I'm Kurt Collada from Hardcore Gaming 101.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Good to have you back on the show, actually.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a while. And next up?
I'm Jared Petty from Limited Run Games.
It's good to have you back. And finally...
I'm Joe Modulewski, also from Limited Run Games.
Wow, yeah. What a coincidence. Great to have you back.
Thanks.
So this is one of those kind of softball episodes where I just give everyone a prompt and we start just talking about stuff. And there's no real notes, just a list of titles that we want to mention at some point. We'll just take turns talking about stuff and we'll see where this goes. These are always fun, but, you know, we've done some topics such as... Boy, what were those topics? They were really cool and fun. And I don't remember off the top of my head what they were because I'm jet lagged and extremely tired. But we've done some softball episodes recently. And here's another one. This time, the question is, what are some misunderstood games? And there's two sides to this question. There's games that we admit that we misunderstood. We, despite our infallible nature as cool retro game podcasters, didn't quite get the first time we played and have come around to appreciate many years later. The second question is, what games has humanity failed to understand? This is not us talking about how cool and smart we are and how stupid everyone else is. It is just saying, like, you know, collectively, these games don't necessarily get the respect that they deserve, or at some point they haven't gotten the respect, and it's taken people a while to come around to them. So that's kind of the direction we're going with. There's not really much of a preamble for this one, so we're just going to jump right in. So everyone here except Joe put down a title that we failed to understand the first time we played.
I didn't put one down, but I'll go last because I have one.
I'm putting you on the hot spot because you did not contribute to the notes.
I just didn't put it on the notes, mm-hmm. but I you didn't have one.
You didn't participate, so here's your lack of participation trophy. Mm-hmm. You get to go first. So what is a game that you failed to understand? Why did this happen, and how contrite are you now?
This will probably really bother Jared because he knows how I feel now, and he probably wishes I still felt this way. But a game that I failed to understand the first time around was Killer Instinct. I was a big fan of Street Fighter II growing up, and Killer Instinct was a game that got a lot of buzz in the arcades. It was very very loud, very popular, very aggressive. Always had a crowd around it when I was young and went to go see it and stuff like that. Played it at my friend's houses on Super NES, and it plays so very differently to the SNK, like Neo Geo fighting games that all kind of still feel at least like comparable to Street Fighter. You can pick one of them up and understand how to play it. The back and forth mechanics of that game and how you play it against another person were so different to Street Fighter that I didn't understand it, and I thought it was janky and terrible and really bad. So I hated it. I didn't come back around to actually understand the depth of that game's mechanics for many, many years. And now it's one of my favorite fighting games of all time.
So you're saying it actually does have depth.
It does.
It has mechanics.
It has mechanics.
Wow, this is news to me.
It has depth. It has mechanics. It is a game that is very much its own beast, but I approached it like every other 90s fighting game and was very terrible at it and never understood how to play it.
and I came back later, and it's, again, like I said, now one of my favorite fighting games of all time.
Much like The Incredible Hulk and Thor, Joe and I are friends from work, and we enjoy talking about video games at work a lot, and Killer Instinct is one of the ones we've kind of habitually bounced around. Mm-hmm. It's not a game that I enjoy the way that Joe does, but I do think he's identifying something very mechanically interesting about it. The problem with Killer Instinct, from my opinion, the reason it's misunderstood, is it is not a fighting game. Not the original arcade version. The remake absolutely is a fighting game, but the old one isn't. It's a two-player rhythm game with very convoluted controls. It's a competitive rhythm game. It's about striking at the right second, then keeping your rhythm going. The juggling that we joke about is actually a viable video game mechanic. It's just nothing like a fighting game. And I think that is, I'm not going to use Secret Genius as a jump, because I don't actually find the process fun. But I do think that's the core of what people find value about in Killer Instinct that are really into it.
So
am I overstretching there?
No, it's a very bombastic game. And I think one of the things that people do find really interesting about it is when you do learn how to play it the way it wants you to play it, it's very over the top. It's very aggressive. It's very, it's less, I guess, reaction based like many fighting games can be. And it's more about like finding that initial setup and not just taking advantage of an opening, but taking advantage of that opening and grinding your opponent into the dust. And you do that, like you said, it is played kind of like a rhythm game. There is a rhythm to how moves kind of flow into each other and how combos are made, but it's not really spoken to the player in any language that makes sense, especially if you're playing fighting games at the time.
Yeah, I remember reading the Nintendo Power specials trying to explain the dial-a combos, and I was like, huh? But basically, it's a fighting game where every character has the potential to be an SNK end boss.
Yeah, basically, yeah. You can hit somebody, and as long as you know what you're doing, like you can never let them hit you back. And it's not intuitive, it's not approachable, but when you learn how to play it, there is nothing from that era that's quite like it. So I went from this being a game that I, you know, totally didn't understand, totally hated, and now it's I have an arcade cabinet of it, I love it, I play it all the time, and I will never let it go.
It's a fighting game designed by people who grew up playing racing games. Racing games are...
They grew up making racing games.
Making games, exactly. Yeah, they did grow up making racing games. And it plays to that racing game memorization arc, like something that I've never been into racing games because a lot of racing games are about memorizing tracks. Killer Instinct requires you to memorize those rhythmic functions. It's not prompting you. You're not matching any on-screen, or at least not obvious on-screen prompts. So it exists at that weird intersection. I don't find it fun, but I imagine anybody that's willing to put the work in, it's got to be feel
that's
really
the, that's
rewarding.
The problem is you have to put like this work in, and it's like that it's a video game, it's hard to go to people and be like, no, yeah, really, like put this
no,
in.
No, I when I want it. To unwind after work, what I really want to do is have a part-time job.
Yeah. You want to learn this arbitrary like proprietary language that applies to this one thing, and but like when you do it, like the game's awesome.
All right, Joe, thank you for participating.
Yeah.
It was very nice of you. So I want to carry this like game that appears to be one thing but is secretly a rhythm game thing forward and pass the microphone to Kurt, because the game that you put down here is exactly that.
A Vagrant Story. Yes, it's a game I wouldn't exactly say I've fully come around to. Like, I don't love it the way that people loved it at the time when it came out, or still love it today, but I've come
it
to...
It makes me go doki doki.
I've come to appreciate it a little bit more. Because, I mean, PS1 Square era was full of so much cool stuff. Like, you had the typical Final Fantasy games that were really popular, but they were like standard JRPG games.
No, even the Final Fantasy games, like occasionally, with 8 especially, was just like, hey, you know all that stuff you think you know about RPGs? No, actually, no.
But it still borrowed like the framework of every other Final Fantasy game. But then you also had like Legend of Mana, you had Parasite Eve that were really, really unique, all the Saga games, which we didn't get up until that point. So I was approaching Vagrant Story from that angle. The magazines at the time had also advertised it as being like a Metal Gear Solid RPG, which graphically you can sort of make that argument the way that the cinema scenes, for as much as they are in the game, are a little bit like that. But as far as the game, I never wrapped my head around all the different attributes, because you have different weapon styles, you have different like enemy types, and there's like a third type of attribute in there too, and it really just assaults you with information. Yeah. And like your weapon types are constantly changing based off of how much you use it.
You start the game with I'm trying to remember, like, eight weapons.
Yeah.
Eight weapon types. And you have to constantly switch between them based on the enemy you're
fighting. Yeah, and it's a little difficult because, like, there's no quick switch in the game, so you always need to go into menus and things, and it was just really tedious. And the strategy guides weren't exactly the best way, teaching you the best way to play the game. And, you know, over the course of the years, the guides have sort of homed in on the correct way to play it. Like, you don't need a weapon for every single type. Like, as long as you have, like, the three main, what is it, like, blunt-edged, poking, whatever they're called, that are appropriate for each enemy type, you're going to be relatively okay. The other part, like you were talking about, is the sort of rhythm game, where every time you get into a fight, you have to hit the buttons at the right rhythm to keep the combo going. And there's nothing about that I found intuitive, because there are animations that you're supposed to use to time it, and they don't feel natural at all. Like, the characters don't move smoothly. They sort of, like, stop and jerk in certain moments. And the way the mechanics work in the game, it's not even always advantageous to keep combos going.
Yeah, it's really weird. You have to, like, have this constant balance. You can't damage enemies effectively by hitting them once.
Yeah.
But when you maintain a chain, you start increasing something called risk, which makes you more vulnerable to being attacked and injured and suffering fatal damage. And once risk rises, it doesn't drop naturally, if I recall correctly. You have to, like, get items that reduce it for you.
It goes down over time, I'm pretty sure. Like, but, like, when in the middle of combat, like, you need to use an item to get to it. So I would get up to a boss and actually manage to damage it enough, but then the risk would be incredibly high. So when it counterattacked, immediately dead. Like, that was it. And stuff like that was just like, all right, screw it. I'm going back to playing Chrono Cross, whatever else came out. But the style of it, again, over time, I really began to appreciate. It has a very moody vibe to it. it's that sort of style. Like, I don't think of very many 3D games in the era that I still like. Like, you know, like, styles come back and you see people making PS1 style games. Again, that's kind of like a romanticization of it, because 95% of things still look really bad. But Vagrant Story was one of those 5% that, you know, even looking back and playing on original PlayStation, it still looks pretty cool. Just the way that they texture map things and kind of make them look like real people in a way that even was better than Metal Gear Solid, because they had faces. It was a nice touch.
I can understand why you didn't appreciate Vagrant Story.
Yep.
I loved it right away, but I'm a big dork, so.
Yeah, I didn't understand all the subsystems. It's so, like, I was approaching it from the mindset of, like, thinking it was maybe like a Diablo sort of hack and slash. That they just was like, oh, this is a little bit too easy and boring. Let's layer all these systems on top of things. And I didn't get it. And eventually, you know, I sort of got it at a certain point.
All right, Jared, what about you? What was the game that vexed you?
NetHack. I thought that's a lot understandable. About this. Yeah, that vexed me a lot. But it vexed me it intrigued and vexed me. So NetHack was something I stumbled upon when the internet was in its infancy. And NetHack is, despite the fact that net's in the name, not a network game. It is a roguelike, ASCII graphics, dungeon adventure. And when I first encountered it, I was fascinated by the number of things that the creators of NetHack, over the long years that had already been around, had anticipated that people might try. NetHack has item interactions that rival the greatest hijinks you've ever heard from Dwarf Fortress, for example. It's just a place where almost anything you want to try with something, somebody has tried and written very specific code to deal with that combination of events. And that was intriguing to me. Plus, I already enjoyed things from that rogue tradition. I liked the idea of making a one-shot run. I'd played these games before. I liked the ASCII graphics weirdness. The problem was that I got stuck. I was very stubborn, and I completely, very literally misunderstood NetHack. I thought NetHack was something like Angband, and I was supposed to descend into a dungeon, fight monsters, get treasure, make my way down, find the Amulet of Yundor, and ascend.
That's not what you're supposed to do?
Not really. Because NetHack is ultimately, despite the fact that being the goal of the game, NetHack is more of a cryptogram than it is anything else. It took years. And really, it took Demon Souls and Dark Souls to make me understand that what NetHack actually is a hub for community storytelling. NetHack is a place that adventures come out of where people share discoveries. It is a game that, despite the fact that it's not an online game, is entirely dependent on community to be enjoyable. Because NetHack has what they call spoilers, from minor to mind-blowing. And these spoilers, discovered by strange people who went mad from seeing Eldritch sigils in their runs 20 years ago, have become the foundation for actually ever having a prayer of completing this game. It is not a game that's meant to be played in the dark. It is not a game that is enjoyable being played in the dark. It is the opposite of that. It is an experience of exploration that is meant to be shared with other people's accounts, and you share yours. And that, when that key turned, and again, it was kind of the Demon Souls, Dark Souls experience that made that happen, where those communities exist and share those kinds of tales, I suddenly like, oh, this game has gone from being deeply frustrating to one of my favorite things. I have never successfully ascended to this day. I love NetHack. I'm close, but I've never ascended. And I don't care anymore, because that's not really the point of the game. The point of the game is one more stupid death, and the point of the game is telling that story.
Now I want to play this game.
So I guess that brings it to me. I don't really have that much of a story to tell. The game that comes to mind for me is Klonoa for PlayStation, a game that I love dearly. It's so wonderful. But the first time I played it, I guess I was still kind of enthralled by 3D gaming, you know, N64 games, Mario 64, that kind of thing. And going back to this kind of extremely minimalist platformer, 2D, it just didn't click for me. It seems so easy and so simple. Like, you only have two action buttons, jump and grab. And I played almost to the end of the game and thought, why am I doing this? And it wasn't until like a year later that I said, you know, I bought this game, I might as well finish it up. I sat down and started playing and was like, oh, you know what? This is actually really good. It has great music. It's got really charming visuals. It's got this really beautiful world that it takes place in, and the camera is constantly shifting around to show these vistas and perspectives to really kind of pull you in or draw you out. And it just feels like a really well-crafted experience. Now that I kind of know what I'm in for, I can appreciate it better. And I realized that, yes, the controls are very simple, jump and grab, but everything in the game is based on just those two verbs. And you get a double jump out of it. But the double jump, you can also sacrifice the object you used to double jump to throw at enemies instead. You can throw into the 3D plane sometimes. There's a lot of subtle complexity that emerges from Klonoa's design. And I just wasn't like in the right mindset to appreciate it, I guess, the first time I played it. So I'm glad I went back and tried it again, because it would be a horrible loss if I didn't have that experience, if I hadn't, you know, enjoyed that game. But it just took me a while to get there.
So that's a game that I actually skipped for a lot of the reasons you're describing. Just never played it. And I know they just had a new version of that come out. And now, again, now you're making me think that I should play this game.
It. I'm not crazy about two, but the first one is really just a sweet, simple, and shockingly moving game. Like, by the time you get to the end, you're like, no. Like, you'll be crying. It's just like manly tears, you know? It's a game with a lot of heart.
That was something I wanted to ask you, Jeremy, when you were describing that. You mentioned that the gameplay-wise, you didn't really get it the first time around. Did it emotionally strike you the first time around, the story?
No, I just kind of like, just kind of slid across the surface of it. I didn't quite get to the gut punch of the ending.
Oh, okay.
And the things that kind of happened along the way, I was just kind of like, stuff's happening, I don't care. It wasn't until the second time I played where I was like, all right, these people have like a weird babble talk. I guess that's okay. I'll actually pay attention to what the text says. So, yeah, it just took me a little while to get there. But I got there, and now I can say, go play Klonoa. Buy lots of copies of it so Namco will make new Klonoa games.
I had a similar experience with the to you with Klonoa. I played it and I liked it, but I didn't really love it because it is, again, it's a little too simple. It's a little short too.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's only 12 levels or so, which even back then compared to like, you know, Yoshi's Island is roughly around the same period of time. So it's a much longer game. But again, I started again a couple years later because there were parts of the game that still kind of stuck with me. And one of my favorite like levels in any platformer ended up being stage 3-2, which is a section where you're sort of like going inside the tree and hitting those little, you know, riding around the rafts and all sorts of stuff like that. And just the vibe of that world, like, I absolutely love it. And that's what, you know, got me back into it. Just created a sense of place that other platformers, even 2D platformers, had never, I never got something similar.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a game, you know, where Klonoa went from a game that's not, it's all right to, okay, yeah, this was, you know, something special.
I flashed to, for to have a Chairman Kaga moment here for a second, if memory serves, GameSpy was my introduction to Klonoa. I missed it when it was brand new, and somebody there recommended it. And I remember thinking when I first played it that this was the sequel to Super Mario 2 I'd never gotten because of those jump grab mechanics. Hmm. Now, it's not the same, but I was like, oh, what a natural evolution of that. And I love Mario 2, so Klonoa just bowled me over. I was really lucky to be grabbed by it. But I was kind of hungry for platformers at that point, too. I'd been playing a lot of PC games around then, and it kind of felt like coming home to just grab a side-scrolling platformer.
Yeah, actually, Kurt, I'm glad you mentioned Yoshi's Island, because that was actually, now that I remember, a part of it. Because it does have so many mechanics that are similar to Yoshi's Island, but simplified.
Yeah.
Like, you grab and throw things, but you can't throw 360 degrees. You can only throw straight ahead or into the 3D plane. You can do, like, the hover jump, but it doesn't have nearly as much utility as in Yoshi's Island. So.
Yeah. And I think when they made all those portable Klonoa games, and I think they realized that, oh, okay, without the visuals, this game doesn't quite work. So they really amped up the puzzle platformer mm-hmm. elements in those games in particular.
Yep. Yeah, some of the bonus stages in those games are just like, how do you do this? Anyway, so like I said, Klonoa, it's good. I was wrong, and I'm glad to admit that I was wrong because it means that now I'm right. So now it's time for us to tell you, the listener, why you were wrong and why we're right. No, not really. It's really this entire segment kind of grew from the seed of me thinking about Bokoska Wars. A very sort of infamous game. It started life as, I want to say, a Sharp X1 game, where it probably made a lot more sense. And it was then ported to Famicom in 1985. And in the early days of emulation, people, you know, got their hands on all these ROMs that had been dumped to the internet. And there was this period of discovery where kids who grew up with the NES were like, oh, there's all this stuff that never came to the US over in Japan. I'm going to try all these out. So they would just get all the ROM dumps and work their way through them, you know, starting with like the 99 fortune telling game and what's down there at A, like
Alpha Mission. Yeah.
Yeah. Alpha Mission came here. No, it didn't actually. Did it? Yes.
I think it did.
Asmic.
Like, yeah. B-Wings, you know, things like that. Anyway, Bokoska Wars starting with a B, is pretty early on in the alphabet, and therefore was pretty early on in these ROM lists. So I don't know that anyone ever made it all the way, not many people made it all the way through Z. But, you know, people would keep playing and just, like, scanning these games for 15 or 30 seconds and saying, is this good, is this not? Just mostly throwing it away, because most of those Famicom games that didn't make it over here didn't make it over here for a reason. Bokoska Wars is one of those games where if you don't know what's going on, you pick it up, you're like, this is, what the hell is happening here? This is stupid and bad. Why would I even want this? Because you're like this little guy and you move around, but the scrolling is horrible and choppy. It like scrolls an entire like tile at a time, 8 pixels or whatever. And your guy moves around very awkwardly, and there's things moving around you, and you're kind of in this map, and there's other guys that you can interact with, and they'll kind of stick to you, and then you'll touch something, and all of a sudden it switches to a screen where stuff is happening that you don't seem to be in control of, and that happens enough, and then it switches to a screen that says, wow, you died. And, you know, people without context or explanation played this and were like,
it's like that worker
in the stupidest, worst thing imaginable.
It's like that worker in Parasite cartoon from The Simpsons. Like, what did I just see? It's over.
Exactly.
Well, there's that moment in every Game Center CX where RNO picks up the manual after 20 minutes, you know, and that's definitely the vibe you get from this one.
Right. But the thing is that in 1996, 1997, people were not scanning and translating Japanese Famicom manuals.
Oh yeah, you're reading my mail.
They were just dumping the INES format ROMs and sticking them on a GeoCities site or an AOL site. Angel Fire, delete after 24 hours. It was early days, and no one got this game, and I never even tried it. I didn't hear about it until later. When, I want to say, the Macross SimpleNet crew, who later established Zany Video Games Quotes, reviewed it and made fun of it. But then, if I remember right, they kind of started to figure out what the point was and realized, oh, this is actually a strategy game. Mm-hmm. It's a very abstract, simplified strategy game.
There's a sequel now.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's download only. Came out a couple of years ago. I could also figure it out.
I think I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they actually made it substantially more complex, and I never sat down and figured out exactly what was what. But yeah, so if you want to play Bokoska Wars 2, it's $15 on PSN.
There you go. Kurt, before a big chunk of this episode got deleted, you made a great point about the technical limitations of the Famicom versus the X1.
Since it was originally developed for the Sharp X1, it could hold more sprites. So, like, one of the big points, the strengths of this game was that you really felt like you were, like, commanding an army of, oh, you know, maybe a dozen or two of how many could fit on the playing field. But the Famicom has a much tighter sprite limitation, so it just couldn't give that same sensation. So it sort of, like, takes a big chunk out of the heart of it. But if you, set up an emulator for an old Japanese PC, then you can see how it was meant to be played and maybe appreciate it a little bit more.
Anyway, I don't know that it's an amazing game, but it's definitely of its time, and for better or for worse, there is more happening in the game than initially appears to be the case. So, yeah, for those kids in 1996, 97, just browsing through their ROM piles and saying, what the hell is this? There's more there. Give it another shot, kids.
That may have been me. Might have been me.
Jared, I know you have to leave a little early, so I'm going to ask you to give us a couple examples of games that you feel were tragically misunderstood.
Yeah, the first of these is one that's come up on Retronauts many times, and that's Mule, which is a four-player planetary economic simulator that sounds just like unfathomably boring when you try to describe it to people, and therefore you can never get them to try it. But if you can actually get four people in the same room to play this game, it is a riot. It is a pure delight. It's one of those marvelous video games where everybody has to cooperate to some degree to stay alive, but someone eventually has to betray everyone else to win. that tension is not happening really in a turn-based environment. That's what makes it work. This is a game you can play with a joystick and a button for each of you, despite being an economic sim. The supply and demand and risk and reward are all happening in real time. They're all happening very fast, and it's built around, again, something that sounds so boring, an auction mini game that is all about action-based auctioning, and I'm not going to dare try to describe how that works here. But you tell people it's about little robot mules and a space colony, and there's no combat, no violence, and no direct way to attack anybody else. And you're just like, no, seriously, supply and demand, man, you're going to love it. And then there's like a 10-minute learning curve. We have to learn to walk to the store and back. And getting people past that is nearly impossible. And it's just a tragedy because Mule really does have a cult following. It was very popular with certain folks back when it first came out and kind of built an evangelistic advocacy that's continued to this day in small circles of the internet because it was so forward-thinking. It really was. It's one of the more delightful early four-player experiences that you can have. And a Mule would work just as well today. It's a precursor in a lot of ways to something like Mario Party. But it's better, and it's tragically misunderstood. I cannot encourage you enough. If you have a way to play Mule and four controllers, do it. That's the other problem. It's just deeply inaccessible now. It's just not a game that there are a lot of great ways to play.
There's the NES version.
There is the NES version, and it's a fine port. So if you've got an NES 4 score laying around, four NES controllers, and a copy of Mule, and three friends, this is the way to do it.
Sounds like a hot tub party.
I mean,
sounds
absolutely.
Like, sounds like we all need to play Mule.
Something I've always wondered about, was this in any way inspired by Foundation? The Mule has always made me think, is this like an Asimov thing? And I've always been a little confused by the fact that it seems to have nothing whatsoever to do with Foundation.
No, as far as I'm aware, there's no connection at all to the Mule and Foundation.
All right.
If there is, I've never heard it written about anywhere. But Bunton made amazing stuff. You know, Modem Wars, Mule, all kinds of other crazy things. This is, a bona fide lost masterpiece. And I'd really love to see more people get their hands on it. Terribly misunderstood by folks. Because it looks boring as all if you look at screenshots or even watch a video of it. And if you play it single player, it is boring. There's no reason to play this game with fewer than four people. That's the other stipulation of it.
Why are we making a podcast now instead of playing Mule?
The other one, I you got a ton of them here, but the other one I'm going to talk about for a second, I already did Raiders on an earlier Retronaut, so we can advocate for that for another one. Is the best single-player Grand Theft Auto game. And that would be GTA Chinatown Wars for the Nintendo DS, and specifically that version of it. A game that was certainly liked when it came out, and a game that, like many GTA games, is full of problematic content. But in terms of mechanics, there's no more delightful Grand Theft Auto experience. It was purposefully built for what you could do with a DS, and it adapted Liberty City to a top-down perspective that was refreshing, and the controls just felt chef's kiss perfect. They found ways to work the stars instead of creating a... They just rewrote the star system and said, no, this is a game about driving a car fast. So we're going to make the star system escape about wrecking police cars in this combo sequence. And it's so much fun. Like, it's maybe the most fun game to get into hijinks in all the Grand Theft Auto series, because it's so much fun to get out. Instead of hiding in a corner, you are proactively incentivized to do battle to get out of the star situation. In a very specific way. And of course, it has the old Space Trader Drug Wars minigame built in, which is one of the best things about it. Hidden all over the city is a buy low, sell high drug dealing game that becomes fundamentally addictive. It is built on that old text-based Drug Wars game, and with the Grand Theft Auto context, it's so much fun, and the rewards are significant enough for it that it's not just some side distraction. Some GTA games, you do a side thing and the rewards aren't actually all that great. You could make a killing in that game if you buy low, sell high, just the right way. And it almost turns it into a kind of a Sid Meier's Pirates trader underlying current to it. I'm talking a lot here, but do you all like this game?
I've never played it, but it sounds like it's good.
So. I always feel bad for not having played it because I was the DS guy for so long at 1UP. And actually, I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast before. I can't remember. But I kind of discovered that this game was going to exist long before it was announced. Because I was flying back from some sort of event in New York. And on the same flight as me was someone, a representative from Rockstar, who I kind of had known, you know, in passing through events and stuff like that. And we got to talking on the plane. And, you know, I had a DS with me and was playing games. And, you know, just in the course of talking about GTA and the DS, he asked, so if you were to make a GTA game for DS, how would you make it? Mm. And I said, well, and I just started kind of like rattling us off some ideas about how to present it and how to control it. And he kind of like got really blank faced and went really quiet. Like, I kind of intuited that I had just described the DS game that they were making.
They should bring you on to their design team.
And he was like, I think he was like, I might get in trouble for this by accidentally kind of tipping our hand here. But it was just interesting because I basically predicted this game just like rattling off some free association ideas for how to do GTA and DS. And then I never got around to playing it just because I, you know, like, who has time to play games that they're not assigned to review?
You willed a game into existence.
That's great.
And didn't even play it.
Something like that. Anyway, it's just a funny memory. Like, just the look on their face, just kind of, you know, going from smiling to this blank, almost like a little hint of panic in the eyes. Yeah, it was...
I love that. Well, the story is whatever, but it just nails the GTA beats. The open world fooling around feels great. You're incentivized to just see how you can push boundaries, but also the mechanical structure is rock solid. It's tighter than any other GTA game, and I really love that about it. And the PSP version's fine, but the DS version it was built around these very specific limitations of the DS, and you can tell. It just feels better on the DS.
Well, why don't we give you one more just to see if you can get it in there before you have to take off.
All right. I'm going to do one more here. If that's the case, again, we talked Raiders. I'm going to go in another direction that I think that is a little off-brand for me, maybe. And that's to talk about a kind of game I don't play much of, an MMO. That would be EVE Online, a very old MMO, almost 20 years old now. And
is it really that old?
Yeah, he's been around a very long time.
Wow.
And EVE, I think, is among the most misunderstood of all video games. You bring EVE up, and people make the spreadsheet joke instantly. You've heard it, I assume. Mm-hmm. You know, to say it's a great game for people who love balancing spreadsheets. EVE is the lost branch of massive multiplayer game design that might have happened and then didn't. It is what it feels as much like Ultima Online as it does like anything else. It is a game about what if we put a bunch of people in a world and then gave them agency over that universe and let them define what it would be. And instead of it becoming pure anarchy, although there are moments of pure anarchy in war and EVE, they created an environment where structure was born out of that tension, and the entire galaxy is defined by its most involved players. Mechanically, Eve is largely about resource management, but one of the reasons that resource management is so important is because the very thing that keeps the game from devolving into anarchy is that Eve has a significant risk factor for anything you do. There are real penalties for death. You do not want to die in Eve, which means just running off and goofing around and doing something chaotic is horribly, horribly counterproductive. You are incentivized to play responsibly. That doesn't mean you don't do evil things. You just don't want to get caught doing evil things. So, you know, that it's really, really well put together. Eve, in my limited time playing it, led to more beautiful, unfathomable moments. Watching one day a Starfleet waiting to ambush another, itself ambushed by a cadre of cloaked ships that were waiting, and all of these being 70 or 80 players, organizing an attack that had a counterattack, that these wars that go on that you read all about. It is what I hoped MMOs were going to become. I don't play Eve because I shouldn't play Eve. It's too good. I left Eve behind because I would like to have other things in my life. But I do think it's deeply misunderstood because its combat and progression are relatively simple. It's no more a spreadsheet than Dragon Quest is. It's fun the same way, except it's interactive. I talked a lot there again.
Yeah, so how do you feel it's misunderstood? Just that people think it's spreadsheet?
I think that people don't understand what kind of MMO it is. I don't think people understand that have played things like World of Warcraft or even more action-oriented massive games like Destiny 2, for example, get that this is about the opposite of structure. There is tons of structure, but it's all player-defined. And I don't think people get that the game is the meta. The game is the community. The game is the alliances that are going on. The game is the newscasts that are being broadcast. The game is the battle you know is coming a month ahead of time that was not created by some dev in Iceland, but that was created by groups of hundreds of players that decided it would be fun to start a giant war. That the fact that laws and star systems are defined by the people in them. I don't think people get that that's the game and the mechanics all serve that. And that's why they're simple.
So how hands-on is the developer with this game?
Extremely.
Okay. It doesn't sound like they have, you know, like Wrath of the Lich King type expansions and things like that.
They add content, but that content is all built around enabling the players further to try new things. That's the focus. Like, if we give players this toolbox, they will create new and unexpected ways to leverage this into good storytelling. This will allow them to monitor something they couldn't before. This type of ship will allow something to happen strategically that hasn't been allowed before. But we aren't going to create... There are scenarios in Eve. When you start out, you're playing against AI. But the core game is about getting out of low-sec space out into player land. Once you've learned that tutorial, you step out into the Wild West. And yet even that's very cultivated because when you go out there, you're so small, you're not worth bothering about the first time. So it's not like people bully you. As a matter of fact, they usually take you under their wing and you get brought into something. It's very immersive in that regard. The way they're involved, they literally have community members come to their headquarters in Iceland and sit down as a council and be like, okay, how do we make the game great next year? That is a big part of how this company operates. There's like a ruling council of player representatives that speak for the community from the big corporations.
The gamer HOA.
Yeah, kind of. So I hope I've described that adequately, but it's unique, but I think it's misunderstood, and I don't think a lot of people try it, and when they try it, they stay in low-sec space and are like, well, these are just the same kind of tutorials I'm used to from most games. Where's my raids? And it's not a game about raids. It's not a game about dungeons. It's not a game about the structured, streamlined experience that you would get from something like WoW. It's a game about player generated challenges, not programmed, but interactive and live.
That sounds really interesting, but also like something I would never want to touch.
I definitely think that now that you, understanding it, I can totally see somebody going, yeah, but I don't want that. You know?
Like, I love reading, you know, the Something Awful forum threads about Eve incursions or, you know, just other forum threads. Like, when people take those moments of where you know, all these elements kind of come together, it's like, almost like the way you've described it and the way it kind of manifests in these events, it's like weather. Like, weather is always there and always exists, and every once in a while, the conditions are right to create a tornado.
Yeah.
When all the systems come together. But most of the time, it's just like, you know, clouds drifting past.
It's very Ian Malcolm. Yes, absolutely. I think you nail it there. It's a lot of how it feels. And
again, was I supposed to do a Jeff Goldblum there? I can definitely try, you know, just do what I want.
Love it.
Yeah, anyway.
No, I think it's a misunderstood game just because I hear it frequently disparaged by folks that have never played it very long. And again, I was never a deep Eve player by a long shot. I just couldn't stop playing, and I was like, oh, this is maybe not good for me.
Speaking to what you're talking about as far as like the misunderstanding of it, my understanding of that game is literally nothing but its barrier to entry to get to the part that you're describing. Right? That's kind of, I think that speaks to what you're saying. It's like, if I don't go out of my way to learn more about what this game is on a surface level, all I've ever heard and known about this game is that it is a lot to get into it and not worth my time, basically. Right? So, yeah, this sort of story that you're telling, this picture you're painting of the game, is not something that I feel is publicly, like, communicated to people.
Well, you love to play Destiny, Joe, and I know that a lot of people that play Destiny have kind of a hate-hate relationship with the game they love. And one of the things a lot of Destiny people tell me is, I play because I get to play with my friends. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always mad at the content, but I love getting together. It's just fun. Eve is what would happen, like, if you're doing that, but Destiny were good.
You're not going to punch him over.
There's no punching back, because okay. I'm not going to argue that Destiny's good. I'm letting him.
Fair enough. All right, Jared, I know you have to take off and do work and things like that. So before you go, where can people find you on the internet to harass you to play more Eve Online?
Well, definitely. Every day I'm over there at Limited Run Games, making podcasts and writing blogs and doing other things with Jeremy Parrish and with Joe. But you can find me at the Top 100 Games Podcast. We're just on Twitter at Petty, Jared. And that's a good place. So I'm going to say, so long, farewell. It's time to say adieu.
All right.
Adieu. To you and you and you.
That was very Julie Andrews of you.
I mean, I wish.
I feel enchanted.
There we go. Oh, no.
So now that he's gone, we can really have fun. No, Joe, what do you feel is a deeply misunderstood game?
Okay, so I've got one, and I didn't put it on the list because I didn't realize we could go into this era. But GTA Chinatown Wars, something that came out sometime around the same time. I want to say Rock Band Unplugged for the PSP, I think, is a misunderstood game. What Rock Band Unplugged is essentially a sequel to a game called Amplitude for PlayStation 2, which is my favorite rhythm game of all time. If you're not familiar with what Amplitude is, basically it's a rhythm game where you are playing every instrument in a song. They come at you in lanes in a way that you would be familiar with if you played the Guitar Hero and Rock Band games when those became popular. But you're hitting the notes in each lane is a instrument, and then you switch lanes, trying to play all the instruments in succession. The way Amplitude specifically works is that when you get to the end of a combo on an instrument, say guitar, you break that lane and it will autoplay itself so that you can go play the others. And you're kind of spinning plates trying to keep all of these instruments playing at once. That's what Rock Band Unplugged is. I feel like Rock Band Unplugged sits in this weird place where it was Rock Band on a platform that nobody that was looking for the Rock Band experience would be looking for it on that platform. So it didn't really necessarily appeal to the gameplay or zeitgeist of like what Rock Band players wanted at the time. They didn't know what that game was. They didn't know what Rock Band Unplugged was, and they didn't understand how it could be a Rock Band experience. And the thing is, it wasn't. But because it was not called Amplitude, then you have this whole other set of this niche game, Amplitude, that had a dedicated fan base that they also did not realize that this game existed that was essentially, for lack of a better word, a sequel to Amplitude, but it wasn't marketed that way. It wasn't shown that way. So it feels like there is this whole other group of people that the game should have appealed to, but it didn't simply because of the way it was branded.
So Rock Band Unplugged gets its name because it doesn't use the plastic instruments?
I believe that's the idea, right? It's unplugged, it's not using the instruments, it's played entirely just on the PSP itself. And the only familiarity it has with Rock Band as a brand or whatever is it has the same aesthetic, and it's a game about pushing buttons to hit notes on a musical track, right? That's all it has really in common with Rock Band. I think it got its name, one, cutely from being unplugged, and two, because Rock Band was a phenomenon, and Amplitude was this tiny PS2 game that at the time nobody remembered, it wasn't a big deal. But it's very interesting to me that they, you know, would have gone and looked at, like, how can we market Rock Band and take advantage of portable platforms, and that they dug back into their well and said, well, we've got this game that we can kind of brand it as Rock Band, but it never seemed like that game took off or is discussed in a way that I feel it should from people that still talk about, you know, Amplitude and stuff.
I mean, when I hear Rock Band Unplugged, I think MTV Unplugged. I think, you know, like acoustic performances. I think, you know, Nirvana or Eric Clapton sitting around with an acoustic guitar and like a pair of tablas or something. Like that's not what Rock Band Unplugged says to me. It doesn't say it's the same music you love, but without instruments. It just, like, to me, it says, oh, you know, you've got Rock Band Beatles, you've got, you know, the very kind of specific spin-offs. So now here's the unplugged version where you're going to play, like, you know, acoustic Layla or something.
Right. That's actually kind of interesting, too, to consider that, like, the naming convention of it does kind of give you that idea, especially when there were so many spin-offs at the time, like you said.
Yeah, Rock Band was, it was tied to MTV, wasn't it?
I don't know if it stayed tied to it through its entirety, but yes, for a while it was.
Yeah, so, like, that connection automatically cements the idea of MTV Unplugged.
Right.
But maybe they assumed that MTV Unplugged was so old that no one remembered
it. Or maybe it was also meant to tie, like, maybe it was just meant to be a cute, like nod to that for the naming convention. It could very well be a thing that they thought, like, ah, it's referencing Unplugged. It's also Unplugged because there's no instruments.
Right.
Who's to say? But at the end of the day, its name, aesthetic, and how it was marketed to people, it just, it feels like it never caught on with the Rock Band audience they were trying to market it to, and it also never caught on to the people that should have loved it because it was basically a sequel to one of their favorite music games. Like, you know, and the thing is, Amplitude has a very, very modest, low-key licensed soundtrack, but Rock Band Unplugged has a lot of the benefits of Rock Band, that there's a ton of fantastic, well-known tracks in Rock Band Unplugged, because it has the benefit of the success that Harmonix was currently riding with Rock Band. So it's, I think that game is super misunderstood simply just because it did not appeal to the audience they shot it at, and the audience that should have loved it never realized it existed.
I mean, I feel like they just tripped and fell on their faces with the branding. The name is just, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, but if you have a PSP and you liked Amplitude, play Rock Band Unplugged. It's very good.
Honestly, there probably needs to be a Retronauts on the whole Rock Band thing. That was such a candle that burned so brightly and so briefly.
I am one of the few that still plays very regularly.
because you're one of the few that has space in your house for a lot of plastic instruments.
I just have the drums. It's still, I still feel the best, American drumming. Like it's the best home console drumming game that's ever existed. And I have an electronic drum kit that I also have split out through a MIDI adapter to my Xbox Series X, and I still play Rock Band.
Wow. All right. Kurt, any thoughts on Rock Band Unplugged?
I did not exist, and I did not know it existed until right now, so...
All right, well, in that case, what is a game that you feel deserves more plaudits than it has received from the unwashed, filthy masses?
I want to bring up Rambo for the NES. A game
I'm right
which,
there with you.
Yeah, a game which I did not understand when I first played it. Because I grew up with a Master System, and the Master System Rambo game was basically like Commando. It was an overhead run and gun, which made sense to me. And,
yeah, it wasn't even a Rambo game in Japan, was it?
It was Asura. Yeah, and they didn't even have the license over in Europe, but it was a Rambo game.
I think it was Secret Command.
Command or Secret Commando, depending on what you were looking at the title screen of the package, because I think they were a little bit too close. But, like, the Nintendo Rambo, it was published by Acclaim. I don't think it got good reviews, even though it didn't really... It kind of came out near the end of... Or near the beginning of, like, video game magazines
started
coming out.
Yeah, it kind of came out a little too early to get a lot in the way of reviews.
Yeah, but I remember in, like, the Jeff Roven guides, they were not, like, kind on that game. And even when I played it, it was very strange.
It is a very strange game.
Because it's, like, a side-scrolling action RPG. And you don't even start with a gun. Like, you think of Rambo with him sitting in the forest, you know, shooting his machine gun everywhere. But it's a lot of the time spent just, like, knifing spiders.
Oh, now and I remember flamingos. This game.
Yeah.
That's just like, as soon as you said you don't even start with a gun, I was like, I've played this.
Yeah, you're stabbing butterflies.
Yeah. And it's like a very, very, very strange. So, again, I didn't think much of it at the time. But when Metroidvanias started becoming more popular and people were reviewing the NES library, you know, people honed in on Rambo. It is, you know, basically a Metroidvania. And also Zelda 2, despite being a Zelda game, there weren't many games like it. This is one of the few that is, you know, takes some influence from Zelda 2. So
yeah, it's kind of weird because due to the slow localization of Zelda 2, Zelda 2 shipped in Japan almost a year before Rambo. But Rambo came out here half a year before Zelda 2.
Yeah, because it was Rambo.
So, for those of us who remember it contemporarily, like, this game came out in the U.S. without really that much context of a hit game to kind of explain what you were supposed to do. Like, if you've played Zelda 2, then this game is very intuitive. But if you haven't, then it's a little like, why are there numbers floating up when I stab a butterfly?
Yeah, and I mean, there's still lots of strange stuff in that game anyway, and I think it kind of makes sense if you was, it was developed by the Japanese studio Pakken Video, and previously in Japan, they had made Rambo RPGs that sort of played like Hide Lied and other JRPGs in the era.
Are you talking about like Super Rambo Special?
Yeah, like those sort of era.
I really see that more as like almost a proto Metal Gear.
It is a proto Metal Gear, kind of, but it's in that weird spot where, especially on Japanese PCs, they couldn't do a good commando type game where they really need to do, you know, block by block movement and things like that in order to, like, you know, instead of shooting everybody, you would go next to them and then like hit them like a bump system.
Yeah.
And so I always looked, you know, knowing that now, it's, you know, the RPG elements sort of make sense.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird coincidence because when I was putting together my NES Work series for 1988, Rambo comes right before Metal Gear. So I decided to dig into Pakken Video's other Rambo games for MSX, and it was kind of revelatory. I was like, whoa, this is like Metal Gear. This is, you know, what it wants to be, what Metal Gear actually ended up being. And Metal Gear came like a year later. So it's on MSX, and Metal Gear was on MSX. So I kind of wonder, like, did Kojima play these games? Because he's a big mark for Western films too. So I have to assume here was a game about Western movies on the same platform that he works on. Surely he had to have played Rambo and Super Rambo Special and said, oh, yeah, okay, this makes sense as a way to do a commando-style game. I can do this, but, you know, not bad.
Everything lines up. You got it. Another one I wanted to bring up that's sort of along that line that I didn't even really play until recently.
Sorry, did you have any more to say about Rambo for NES?
About Rambo, nothing else. Other than that, I appreciate it a little bit more, definitely a lot more than I was a kid. But the next one I wanted to lead to was Friday the 13th, which was a game with an infamous reputation. Even back then, I'm pretty sure it was one of the first games EGM reviewed, and they had savaged it. Along with Hydlide.
Just another RPG.
Yeah, RPG. I think Kung Fu, or not one of those karate type games. They're just like, it's another. They didn't really seem to have strict standards back then. But Friday the 13th was a game that I never played much just because it had the reputation of being awful. And you can definitely understand why that is, because it was way too difficult and it is way too vague about what you're actually supposed to be
doing.
And
it's got that LJN rainbow on the cover.
It has the LJN rainbow cover. And again, like, at the beginning, when people were rediscovering all these games, like LJN had this terrible reputation, but we didn't know where these games came from. And we now know that a lot of them came from Japan. Several of them came from Atlus. So for Friday the 13th, which never came out back in Japan, but the goal is just to kill Jason. And what you just need to do is just become more powerful and find all the items you need to get strong enough to fight back against him. But if you look at other games to compare it to, there's not very many. It's sort of similar to a Metroidvania, like Goonies 2 in particular, because you have the side view perspective and you have the 3D view whenever you're moving into an interior place.
And there's Dr. Chaos, which I just recently discovered.
Yeah, that's just also a very Goonies 2 type game. But it's more open-ended than Castlevania 2 or a Metroid. Like, you can sit down and learn those games with a map and eventually be able to play them. But Friday the 13th is much more stressful because you're always under constant attack. Beating Jason is way, 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 way too difficult. But at the same time, it is really neat that they created a game that sort of takes those elements of an exploration of a very small world, but made it more open in a sense how you were learning and how to play it. And again, for years, everybody savaged this game because it was so hard. Like, even beating Jason the first time, very few people, I'm sure, were able to beat him. And there's very little instruction in the game outside of, the game tells you to light fireplaces. Oh, that's, a clue, but it's not the goal of the game. But if you start reading strategy guides, or even better, watch a Let's Play, you can really begin to appreciate, oh, this is really a neat idea for a game. Like, it didn't work because, again, it is too hard. But it's cool. And with one of the interviews with the creators of Jaws, they said they had 3 months to make the game. And it's reasonable to assume that Atlus probably had about the same amount of time to make this game. And it's way too ambitious for something that anybody could make in 3 months. So maybe with enough time.
And so is Jaws, for that matter.
Yeah.
Which is also an LJN game.
Yeah, that's
tries
really
to
weird
have
about.
That gameplay loop. It's a little bit open.
Yeah.
You're building up power. It has these proto-RPG elements. You switch viewpoints. Yeah, there was definitely something in the water.
Yeah.
There's something that's consistent with some of the LJN games there, is that they're not exactly great, but there's ambition in a lot of these games. That makes some of them more interesting than others based on ambition alone. And
some of the early ones, I would say, have more of that when they were working more with Japanese studios. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just because at that point, Japanese developers had years of experience with the NES, the Famicom, and so they felt pretty comfortable with it. Even developers who didn't have a ton of time or didn't necessarily have the best technical expertise, they still knew how to get a lot of things out of the system and had a lot of kind of more context surrounding them. Other people doing interesting things and ambitious things, whereas the studios who did later LJN games probably didn't have that because they were European or American.
X-Men is still really bad, sad to say.
Who developed that one?
I think it might be Atlus on that one.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was ambitious, too. I said, the ambition there was, hey, what if we take a character and the most fun thing about him and punished you for doing it? That's a whole different level of it.
Which one is that?
X-Men.
I mean, which character?
I'm mixing that up. I think I'm mixing it up with Wolverine.
No, you are right, because I think, if you punch in X-Men, don't you lose health?
It's Wolverine. Like, when you use your claws, you lose health.
Oh, no, yeah, that was a different game.
That's
that
a different
game. That was an American studio. The American or European studio.
So I mixed up there X-Men and Wolverine. I believe there was two separate games there.
The other one, you controlled two characters at once, and it was very bad.
It is very bad. Now I know which one you're talking about. Yeah, I mixed it up with Wolverine at first, but no, now I know what you're talking about.
All right, so Friday the 13th, that's one that I will get to eventually with NES Works, and I'm curious to see what I will think of it, because at the time I just said, I don't think this is going to be good. It's based on a movie. It's LJN. I've played other games by them, and they were all kind of a little off.
Find somebody who knows how to play the game and watch them play it and have them explain it to you.
Yeah, I'll probably watch a Let's Play of it or something, or, you know, just a long play.
I had a friend that could, founded a PlayChoice 10 cabinet and was able to beat it there because he just had the game.
Was there like a Versus or PlayChoice 10 Friday the 13th?
Or is that
something that they used an adapter to?
I was going
to
say, I don't recall if there's a PlayChoice 10 version. I have no idea, but they could have put an adapter in, because I have one in my PlayChoice cabinet that you can put just NES carts in there.
Yeah, because it was a timer. Yeah. You would just play until it was ran out.
Of all the games to put in there, like, oh, it's going to be Friday the 13th. I could put, you know, Mega Man 6 in there, or Castlevania 3, or Ninja Gaiden, but no, Friday the 13th.
Yep.
Okay. So I want to throw out a couple of games before we do another round here. This is one I think you are a fan of, Kurt, Gain Ground by Sega.
Gain Ground is another one of those games that, again, first played it, thought it was terrible, but then I read about the, you know, on the Japanese websites, about how they described it as an algorithm action game and how you have to learn the patterns of how everything works.
Interesting.
And that sort of unlocked that passage in my brain, like, oh, you're not supposed to play this game like Commando. This is a puzzle game.
Yeah. To me, this is like actually kind of cut from the same cloth as Bokosuka Wars, where it's kind of leaning into some strategy elements in an action-y sort of way. But instead of being, you know, like abstracted, it's more like it kind of feels like it's supposed to be a shooter, but it's not, or like a melee game. But you're given all these different characters, each of whom has different capabilities, and you're supposed to team up with other people. The arcade, I think, was three people.
It's definitely a two player. I don't remember if
it's more than
three.
It's more than two. Yeah. I think it's three. And, you know, every class has their own abilities and special abilities. And you just basically, you know, it's called Gain Ground, but really you're just holding ground. You're just kind of fighting off waves of enemies. There's kind of like a territory defense, you know, MOBA kind of thing going on, but you're not, you know, stationary. You are like just the hero class moving around fighting enemies.
Yeah, you do have to take it very slowly because, you know, you have enemies that are positioned in a certain way. You might not be able to hit them because they're on different ground, but you have, like some characters can shoot forward, other characters throw spears, which can hit enemies at different heights. So you just, like, find their blind spot and be able to counterattack with what characters you have. And over the course of the game, you only start with maybe three of them, but you rescue them if you can take them across the finish line, and then you can play as them. And there's like 30 or 40 different characters or so, each with different weapon types that you can use in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's great that Sega put this on the Switch Sega Ages.
Yeah.
It was kind of an unexpected pick for them. But the previously, I think the only version that had been available had been the Genesis version, which is okay.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't have all the nuance that the arcade version does.
That was a System 24 game, which ran at a higher resolution. Like, it's not quite SVGA. It's sort of, like, in the middle of there. And the Genesis obviously couldn't do that. So it's as a compromise, the sprites are just very, very tiny. They're not very detailed because they kind of tried to squish everything in here. But you really get a sense of the scale better when it's on the Switch that can show everything properly.
Yeah, but I think when people play Gain Ground, they look at it and they think, oh, this is, you know,
slow like and weird.
Total Carnage or something.
Yeah.
You just got to run around shooting stuff, and that's absolutely not how you play. But when you get it, then it's actually really cool and unique.
Maybe I should check this out then.
Maybe you should.
You're talking about this game, and I'm like, I've never played this. But you just said there's a Sega Ages version Switch.
Yeah.
It has a sort of time travel thing. There's some sort of crazy backstory about crazy computer.
You pick up like a cowboy and a cave woman and a robot. and a knight. So yeah, you're just like traveling across time.
Sounds kind
of something.
Neat.
Yeah, you're like fighting through medieval fortresses and you know, some sort of primitive cave system and a castle. Yeah. So yeah. It's an interesting game. It's just kind of all over the place. But yeah, pretty unique. And I believe it supports Flip Grip on Switch, which is always a plus. Unless you use the Switch Lite, in which case, sorry. Let's see, one other one really quickly, just because I've got to live up to my branding. Zevius by Namco, I don't know that it's necessarily misunderstood so much as just not really valued in the West the way it was in Japan. In Japan, it's impossible to overstate how much people loved that game. It was a huge hit. And when you talk, when you like read developers or talk to, read interviews with developers or talk to developers from that era, you know, who kind of cut their teeth in arcades in the early 80s, and then started making Famicom games or Mega Drive games or arcade games in the late 80s, they're all like, oh yeah, Zevius, like I saw that and it changed my life. It was amazing. You know, when Zevius came home on the Famicom, it just, like, that was when I had to buy a Famicom. That was the game that changed everything for me. It's really interesting. It's a good game. You know, it's an evolution of the Space Invaders concept. You know, you add in the moving enemies with Galaxian and then the enemy patterns with Galaga. And then the next step is to give you, like, the kind of a three-dimensional space with Zevius where you are fighting enemies in the air and also dropping bombs at enemies on the ground. But then it has like interesting scrolling backgrounds and this kind of earworm of a musical loop almost, and really interesting dynamic enemy patterns. Like the longer you survive without being destroyed, the more ferocious enemies become until you die and then they kind of reset to a lower difficulty level. But it just gets harder and harder the longer you play. It's just a really good shooter. And for whatever reason, in America, people are like, meh.
What do you think is like the premier way to play this game? Like, do you think the Famicom, the NES version of this is still totally a great way to play
it? The NES version is good. I think the 7800 version might actually be a little better in some respects. But the best way to play at this point would be to get the Namco Museum or Hamster Arcade Archives version. It's out both ways, I believe, on Switch, and you know, you could do PS4 too, but Switch you can turn it sideways and flip grip it. Not that I'm, you know, stumping for that or anything. It's supported on Mister. That's a great way to play. There are quite a few ways to play Zevius, like the original arcade version, and that's the way I recommend it, because you know, it's a vertical shooter, and okay, so when you fire air-to-air, it's all range. Like, you shoot, it goes all the way off the top of the screen. But your bombs, air-to-ground, you have a targeting reticle, and your bomb is going to land where your reticle is when you fire. And in arcades, because it's a vertical screen, your reticle is, like, I don't know, 6 ship distances away from you. But on NES, because it's horizontal and it's compacted, and your reticle is, like, 4 ship distances away, so you have less room to maneuver. It just feels more cramped. So, you know, it's fine, but I really recommend playing the arcade version.
One of my local arcades has a cabinet of that, and it's a really nice cabinet. Like a lot of
the name Zevius is burned into the screen.
Oh yeah, like all of them. Like I think I haven't tried it, but the arcade archive version apparently has a filter that like mimics.
Yeah, there's That's something funny. About that title screen. I guess because even during the demo, it always has the logo
was on
there
too much.
Yeah,
these arcade cabinets actually pop up a lot in the area, local around here. It seems like they go for not a lot of money, and they're pretty plentiful out there. So
Yeah, I don't know. That was one of those, I played it back when it first came out, and I thought it was really, really cool, and then it disappeared, and I didn't see it again for like 15, 16 years, and I stumbled across it in like 2000, 2001 at a random movie theater. I was like, oh, I remember this game. This game is so cool, and I played it, and I thought it was great still, and then kind of got online reading about it and realized, wow, like, everyone thinks it's stupid and bad.
I was gonna say, I think that speaks to, you know, the narrative you're putting out there about this, is that you know, these arcade cabinets, they still exist. I find them very frequently while I'm just looking at other stuff, and nobody's really buying them. So I think that fits the narrative you're saying about how this game performed over here.
You should add one to your arcade.
Maybe I should.
You should.
It was ported a lot too. Like, I first played it a lot on my Apple II, which was of course a bad port, but it was on a lot of different systems, even on American computers and stuff. But I, like, for some reason, shoot 'em ups just didn't seem to take off in the American arcades the way they did in Japan, and even in Europe they seemed to have a greater enthusiasm for it. And it would be like,
sure,
I've never,
but it's
quite
F1.
I've never been clear why that was. Because, again, it's not like Atari mismanaged Zevius or anything like that. Like, again, like I'm saying, it's a nice cabinet. It just didn't leave much of an impression. But if you start playing any of those, like, Japanese games, like, during the mid-80s, there were a lot of them that were
many Zevius clones.
I think the thing, you know, and maybe this isn't the right way to look at it, but I think the way games expanded here was the more accessible they became, the wider the audience became, and those games were kind of adopted and enjoyed over here more. And ship shooters in general, like shmups and anything like that, they're not accessible. They're easy to play, but they're incredibly difficult. And you kind of think of, like, when this game came out, you put it in the Japanese audience where they're familiar with this kind of thing. They're playing a lot of games that are very challenging. And over here, we're trying to expand and come out of the video game crash. We're trying to expand to audiences with games that are more accessible, easier to understand, less, you know, outright challenging. I think, again, maybe totally off base, but, like, I think that may have played into why that entire genre just never exploded over here the way it did.
Yeah, I kind of feel like after Galaga, which was a big hit here, that genre just kind of subsided and people took more of an interest in, I don't know, what was big.
What else? Like, I mean, Defender was before that. That's 82, and Zevius was 83.
Yeah, but that's not a vertical scroller.
Yeah, but it's still a shoot 'em up, but it's a different type.
Yeah, I mean, you had Asteroids.
But all of these games, you know, they were existing at a time when the novelty of the video game was still very new, right? Yeah. Like, all things considered. And once you're past that, especially in this market, that didn't live on. I mean, like, for whatever the reason is, I don't know, but, like, clearly it didn't live on.
They were nurtured more in Japan. Like, Star Soldier was a big Hudson title, and I don't think that really had much of an impact here. But, I mean, those games were used for national shoot-em-up scoring competitions. And it's not like
Takahashi Meijin's career.
Yeah, and it's not like we didn't have scoring things here, but it always felt like it was, like, something that was only reserved for, like, the back of a magazine where they'd have things. Like, there was
the U.S. video game team.
Yeah, like, it existed, but not really to the same scale as it did in Japan.
Yeah, it's just Japan never lost its enthusiasm for games derived from Space Invaders. And that's still, you know, a huge amount of what you see in Japanese arcades these days.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas here, no, like, I'm trying to figure out, like, what did we switch to? I can't look at, like, 80s arcades
and say,
so, like,
yeah,
there's one thing that is a...
When did this game come out?
83, 84.
82. Yeah. No, Zevius was 82.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, over here.
Oh, but,
yeah.
No, it was still 82.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm drawing a blank. Because I'm thinking more like late 80s stuff, because that's when I...
Yeah, because that's what I was thinking, too, when I was thinking, like, oh, this sort of stuff got left behind. I was thinking late 80s. I didn't realize Zevius came out that much earlier.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty weird. Anyway... I just feel like, yeah, like, Americans don't really get why it's such a big deal. And whenever I talk about it in my retrospective videos about early Famicom games, I'm like, oh, it's another Zevius clone. People are like, okay, you're saying it again. But I mean, there it is. It's right there. And it's not just me imagining it. That gets so much lip service by, you know, key influencers in video games. You know, Gradius was made because Konami wanted to exceed Zevius. They wanted to make a game that was better than Zevius. And they were like, well, they've really got the vertical shooter locked down, so we've got to make a horizontal shooter. And that's where Gradius came from.
Gradius, that's a game I'm very familiar with.
Yeah.
That's a good game.
Yeah.
Those always felt like they were more popular in America. Like, I knew random people that knew what Life Force was. That was a game I did see a lot in the arcades when I was growing up. They had Life Force, but I've never seen many other, like, I've never seen a Gradius or any of those games. Or Nemesis, or whatever it might have been called.
But Gradius was a game that, for sure, I at least anecdotally, seemed popular on the NES. I know a lot of people that had it and played it, and, you know, in a way that I never knew what Zevius was.
Yeah. Gradius 3 was a Super Nintendo launch title, too. So it had that eyes on it.
Yep. All that slowdown. Kids love it. Joe, do you have other opinions about underappreciated video games, misunderstood video games?
Speaking of shooters, shoot 'em ups. This is the last one I'll throw out there. It's Donkey Kong 3.
I was thinking Donkey Kong Country 3. Yes.
Oh no,
Donkey Kong 3. Yes.
Donkey Kong 3, which this one we can keep very short and simple, but I don't know if it's necessarily that the game is misunderstood fully, but it just seems like if it clicks for you that Donkey Kong 3 is a shooter, like it is the Nintendo of that era, right? It's that Nintendo's take on what a arcade shoot 'em up would be. And the game's awesome. Once you kind of like click and change gears and realize that's really
let
what the game is.
Let go of the Donkey Kong you have known before and accept the totality of this new Donkey Kong.
And it is a really great, unique take on like a shoot 'em up game. It's got a ton of character to it. Like when you're blasting at Donkey Kong and stuff like that, his expressions are great. It's just a really unique spin on that, that it just seems like people didn't quite understand what it was. Maybe nobody looks back at that game and really talks about it. It's just the weird one, and that's the bad one, and we don't talk about it.
I mean, as a shooter, it is kind of weird because you've got things that are flying down and attacking you, but you don't really need to destroy all of them.
No, your only real objective is to get Donkey Kong
in the ass
with
poison so he scoots off the top of the screen.
And everything else that's coming at you is really just either to stop you from doing that objective or they're trying to hit you and stuff like that. But then they're also posing potential future threats because they're stealing stuff from you that if they take too much, then you lose. And
yeah, there's a lot of potential fail states in this game.
Yes, there are.
If Donkey Kong drops all the way down the vines at the top of the screen and lands on you, that's game over.
Yep.
If the bugs steal all your flowers, that's game over.
And if the
bugs
hit
you,
it's game over. So it's a challenging game. But I think it's intuitive. I think it makes sense. The controls feel great. It's very snappy. It's kind of, it works more like in lanes than anything else because you move between different platforms, but you're not actually really moving on the Y-axis dynamically. It's just you're snapping up and down on a grid to different platforms.
It's a vertical shooter that doesn't take place in space or with a ship. You don't have free movement around like all of outer space. You have, like you said, like three platforms.
It depends on the stage, right? And then like they'll mix it up by having it so that you can only go up and down on the left side, and then like the middle is missing a platform, so you have to go kind of around in a loop to avoid the bugs and stuff. But it is cool. You're constantly going up and down based on the trajectory of the bugs that are coming at you or where Donkey Kong is. Obviously, the higher up, then you're able to hit him a little easier. The lower down, you're safer, but your shots are not connecting as quickly. It's a very cool game. I think that nobody really looks back and thinks about it, but if you want to kind of go back and explore what a very Nintendo-style shoot 'em up is, they made one, and it's Donkey Kong 3.
Mm-hmm. That was the game that I, again, did not understand, because it's, Donkey Kong Jr., it plays a lot like Donkey Kong. And I had those two games for my Atari growing up. But until I had a friend, like 15 years ago, I saw him at a PAX and he saw a Donkey Kong 3 cabinet and he just got really excited, like, hell yeah! And then, again, it's a shoot 'em up. Mm-hmm. And learning how to play it like that, again, switched my mind on
it. It's one of my grails right now. I've been looking for a Donkey Kong 3 cabinet for a long time.
I would rather play Donkey Kong 3 than the original Donkey Kong, to be honest.
I wouldn't, but I really love Donkey Kong, but I'd much rather play the Donkey Kong Jr.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was the one I spent the most time with because I had it, Donkey Kong
Speaking Jr. of a misunderstood game, there's one, Donkey Kong Jr. People misunderstand it as a good game.
Wow, spicy takes. All right. Moving along. Kurt, do you have another one to throw out there?
Let's see one of the ones I brought up. It sort of dovetails with one you have written down in the notes is Baroque, which was a... the original version didn't come out here, but it is a roguelike made by a company called Sting. The idea is that you're... It takes place in this kind of post-apocalyptic world filled with angels and monsters, and the game is shown entirely from a first-person perspective. But as you go through the game, you... Like, when you die, you don't necessarily die. Like, it doesn't start over. The world persists. And the story and the world outside of it evolve as you continue to go through the game. And that is basically what Hades did. And the whole story of
That's what Sharon the Wanderer did.
Yeah. And it's even more so. Like, there's all these weird triggers and stuff. Like, that's one of those games that even... Like, if you don't have a follow walkthrough, it's difficult to understand that game. But roguelikes weren't understood here when they were brought out. But the original version of Baroque didn't come out here, but it did come out as a PS2 Wii remake. And I think it probably flopped pretty hard, as I don't think it got very good press coverage because, again, people didn't understand even back in the PS2 era what a roguelike was, how it was meant to be played. It was marketed toward a Japanese RPG audience who's more... attuned to what, like, a Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest would be. And it's not like that sort of game at all. And, you know, the closest cultural understanding we had at the time was, you know, Diablo is kind of like... I understood that as being similar to Rogue, but it wasn't really because there's no real permadeath. But that's the closest thing, but it also was nothing like it. So the original version, it actually got re-released here. Or not here, but... in Japan for the Switch. It's like one of those weird... where they took the Saturn game and then emulated it. They didn't bring that over here, but it was fan-translated, like, relatively recently.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. So people are beginning to discover this, and since people get roguelikes now because of... I think Spelunky was really the game that set off that sort of understanding. Yeah. But, you know, indie games kept iterating on it, and now... we can go back and play Sheeran the Wanderer and Tornado the Last Hope. And we're like, oh, this is what this game is. But yeah, I like Baroque a lot, especially the original one because of it has a very gritty horror aesthetic, sort of like what Silent Hill was like on the PS1. The version that we got cleaned that up in a way that I don't think is really beneficial for it. They had also changed the music. Again, the original version had more of a Silent Hill, dark and new techno-industrial feel to it that they had changed completely. But either version of that, again, I think people will get more nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never really played Baroque because I heard the remake was way different than the original Saturn.
Yeah, completely.
Version, so I was kind of, I don't know, for some reason that put me off. But honestly, you could say the same for any roguelike that was localized before Spelunky came out, really.
Yeah. And there weren't many of them.
There weren't, but like I remember seeing every review was pretty much the same. It was like, this game is bad and dumb because when you die, you lose all your experience and you have to start over. So games like Tornado the Last Hope, Chocobo's Mystery Dungeon, Evolution, I think, on
Dreams was another Azure one Dreams, that was like that. That was a whole conglomeration of games that nobody had any understanding Pokemon, of at the time.
Pokemon before Pokemon was big.
Had dating elements in it.
Dating, yep. Roguelike.
Yeah, monster building. There's a lot of weird stuff in that game.
Yep. But yeah, there were a bunch of games like that came out and, you know, just hit this brick wall. And I remember talking to one fellow reviewer about Sheeran the Wanderer for DS and like saying this game is great, and he was like, you know, it's just like, I hate these games where I play and if I die, that's the end. And I said, well, I mean, if you play Super Mario Brothers and you run out of lives, that's the end. What do you do? Do you continue? No, you can't. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess you can, but, you know, like, if you just play by the game's rules, you can't continue. You start over. But when you start over, you know, you have more skill. You know more about the game. You're going to do better. And this is that same concept, just expanded into the RPG format. And the idea is you're going to go into it better armed with knowledge and tactics and skills and just an understanding of the world and your equipment and your abilities, so you're going to do better the next time. But I don't think that really took...
I mean, like, Baroque, again, like Hades, like, there's a story to the game. So each time you might lose, but you uncover a little bit about what's, you know, going on in the game world. And I think that, like, might hit... attract people who are more typically attracted to stories, to role-playing games.
All right, I'm going to wrap it up here with one last game, very briefly touching on a personal favorite of mine that I bounced off of when I first played it as an import, but then once it came and was localized in the US, I tried it again and was like, oh, yeah, this is good. I guess because I had the time to kind of recalibrate my expectations, and that is Mega Man Legends for PlayStation, a game that is really... nothing whatsoever like Mega Man, aside from the fact that there's a little blue guy with a gun arm, and he shoots things.
He shoots mostly. Lemons.
Yeah. He shoots what?
Lemons? He shoots lemons.
Does he?
Yeah.
Oh, they do kind of look like
lemons.
Yeah.
Okay, his bullets, yes. Yeah, I thought you meant, like, he takes aim at lemons and destroys them with
his
gun. No,
he jams up other robots with lemons, and he goes
up
the works.
Sometimes they're big. Sometimes they're, like, I don't know, footballs or
lozenges. Yeah, but when they hit, the lemon juice, it gets in there, and the robot doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It's really acidic and wet. But so many people, myself included, went into this game wanting a Mega Man classic game that just happened to be 3D. And that's not what this is. That's not what Capcom set out to create. They set out to create something completely different. And I would argue that they absolutely nailed it. But unless you kind of go into it expecting it to be not really that much like the Mega Man you know and had played for 10 years, then it's kind of a shock and a disappointment.
That was my experience with it.
Yeah.
But I played it as Mega Man 64.
Oh, well, so, that's going, like, to be disappointing.
There's no
what.
Yeah, there's also no subtitle to give you any sort of implication that this is a new thing. It's Mega Man, but on N64.
64.
Yeah.
Well, I like the first six, so obviously I'm going to like the 64th. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a problem, is that, you know, honestly, if this didn't have the Mega Man name to it, and the ties to the Mega Man franchise are very, very slim, and it would work just fine without them. I think it would have done really, really well. But because it has the Mega Man name, people expected one thing, you know, like a little guy running around shooting robots, taking their powers, using those powers against other robots, and then defeating a mad scientist to the end. And you don't do any of that here. You don't fight any robots named Something Man. It's just like these big, faceless, weird, like single eyeball monstrosities under the ground. And when you destroy them, you don't get a weapon. You have to go back and take random parts to Roll, who is hanging out in an RV and or a van. And you're like, hey, can you turn this junk into a weapon? And she's like, sure, you have to pay for it, though. It all works really differently. It's all totally different. But it really emphasizes, one, the world, and really, like, living in that game world for a little while and getting to know the people, getting to know the town, kind of figuring out how all the dungeons fit together and how everything crosses underground beneath the island, which is really cool. Like, once it starts to kind of come together, it just works really well. And two, it's really about the characters, and specifically the story that, you know, kind of revolves around the Mega Man who stars in this game, who's a different Mega Man. It's very inspired by like Studio Ghibli cartoons and that kind of like classic 70s, 80s anime. It really has that spirit to it. And, you know, that's something that wasn't really big in the U.S. at the time. I think now there's more appreciation for that kind of classic vibe. But, you know, taken on its own terms, it's so well done. Kind of like Klonoa, it's very charming, a little simple, but that works in its favor. They did a great job of imbuing very early PlayStation graphics with a lot of personality and style. It had, you know, fully voiced in-engine cutscenes before Metal Gear came along. And it, you know, it had like a Navi operator in your ear kind of guiding you through the dungeons way before Halo. It had lock-on targeting before Zelda Ocarina of Time. You know, it just did a lot of things that were kind of innovative and fresh and different. But because it did it in the context of a game that is normally about like a little robot guy jumping and shooting and getting new powers and changing color, it just didn't quite land, I think. But I feel like people have come around to this game and really, you know, have come to appreciate it for what it is. But at the time, it just didn't go over that well.
This has always been one of my, like, so you know I'm a really, really big Mega Man fan. This has always been one of my kind of like black eyes on that franchise. I've never gone back and tried this again ever since trying that Mega Man 64. I've had a copy of it sitting on my shelf now for probably about like 4 years or so, and I really should pop this in and give it a shot.
So the best way to play Mega Man Legends now is to download the PS1 Classic on a PlayStation Vita and then sit down and mess with the controls to map the camera and the controls to the two sticks. Mm-hmm. Because this is a pre-dual analog 3D action game. And so it is a little rough. Like, most of the battles against bosses amount to you running in a circle around them and just nudging your camera to target onto the bad guy. And it's kind of, like, that part is pretty simplistic. I think if you put the lateral camera controls on the right stick, it plays a lot more intuitively, and you can do that on Vita, which is nice. That's my recommendation is the best way to play it.
Okay.
I think you can still buy PS1 Classics on the store.
I think so. Sometimes they seem to be randomly delisted. Like, you look for a game, and it's just not there.
But it's not like Nintendo saying, oh yeah, we're taking all this away forever.
Mm.
I think Sony wants to do that, but people
got mad.
Stink that Jim Ryan is like, okay, fine, whatever. You can have your crappy old stupid games, whatever. I'm going to keep making new games, and you can have your bad old stupid bad games. Anyway.
You seem tense. Are you okay?
Yeah, no. Just, I have a strong disagreement with Sony Corporate about the value of games that are more than, you know, a year old. Like, you don't have to just keep remaking The Last of Us. It's okay. It's okay. Just let it be old. It's fine. Do new things. It's fine. Anyway, yeah. So Mega Man Legends. Great game. They're never going to revisit that series. They're never going to make that third one.
Boy, they tried.
Did they, though?
Well, yeah.
That's a good question. Did they really? Yeah, I think Keiji Inafune tried to get it off the ground, and as soon as he left, they were like, yeah, we're cutting this loose. Forget that. Too bad. But the first two games and Misadventures of Tron Bonn are still exist and are still great, and they're very expensive now, so get them on PSN where they're $6 each. The end. All right, gentlemen, thank you, and thank you, Jared, for your opinions and thoughts in this softball episode. It was fun to just kind of shoot the breeze, chew the fat, whatever, about video games that are good, even though people may not realize it. So, yeah, this has been an episode of Retronauts. If you enjoyed what you heard, you should listen to us every week. Next week's episode is going to be completely different than this one, but that's the appeal of Retronauts, in my opinion, is that it's always about old games or old game-related topics, but it's always a little different. It's always a different perspective and a different tone. So, yeah, it's fun. You never know what you're going to get. It's like Forrest Gump's box of chocolates. It's like life.
But with vintage electronics.
Yeah, exactly. So you're probably going to get a capacitor.
I can eat those.
A leaky capacitor.
Yeah. I might not survive, but I can eat that.
Yeah. good deal. So yeah, Retronauts you can find on many different places, including the HyperX Podcast Network. You can find us on podcatchers and various download services, wherever you find podcasts. And if you really enjoy the show, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. For $3 a month, you get every episode a week in advance at a higher bitrate quality than the public feed with no advertisements. That's always an appealing thing. And for $5 a month, you also get Discord access, weekly mini columns and mini podcasts. And every Friday, there's a full-length patron-exclusive bonus episode. That's just $2 more than the standard entry fee. In my opinion, a great upsell. So please, let me upsell you. Patreon.com/retronauts. Kurt, where can people find and support you?
I'm on my website is HardcoreGaming101. I'm on Twitter at HG_101. We also have a podcast called The Top 47,858 Games of All Time, where we discuss a game and then pit it above all the other games on an enormous Frankenstein of a list that we put together over several years. We're also on Patreon at patreon.com/HG_101.
All right. And Joe.
You can find me on Twitter at SuperNESJoe. You could also find me at Limited Run Games, but don't come there. Don't come to the building. Don't come there.
No, we don't want you. Armed guards. Yeah. They'll shoot you. It's really you don't want that.
So yeah, you can find me there, but don't.
Yeah, they can't find you there. That's the thing. The armed guards will see to that.
That's right. That's right.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite, also at Limited Run Games, hiding behind the barricades and the bulletproof glass. So stay away. And also, you can find me on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, doing videos about old video games, including some of the ones I've discussed here, that we've discussed here, which I try to give a fair shake to, even if I don't like them. Actually, especially if I don't like them. I try to be really fair with the games that I think are boring or bad. But, you know, so it goes. I try not to misunderstand games. By golly, we're past that age, you know? We're mature now. We're grown-ups.
No, I'm going to continue to misunderstand everything.
All right. We're mostly grown-ups. If I seem edgy, I want you to know that I never meant to take it out on you. Life has its problems and I've got my share. That's one thing I never meant to do, 'cause I love you.